Okay, please be seated, everyone. And again, I know a lot of students are new. We didn't see our last arguments. So again, I'd like to, on behalf of the Nevada Supreme Court, we'd like to welcome you to our arguments. We're going to do oral arguments just like we do in our courtrooms in Carson City and in Las Vegas. Well, I'd like to introduce, all the members of the Nevada Supreme Court. On the, my far right is Justice Michael Cherry. Next to Justice Cherry is Justice Ron Perigary. On my immediate right is Associate Chief Justice Christina Pickering. Again, my name is Mark Gibbons. I'm the current Chief Justice. On my left will be our incoming Chief Justice in January, Justice Jim Hardesty. Sitting next to Justice Hardesty is Justice Michael Douglas. And sitting at the end is Justice Nancy Sada. So, as
and
you
we
can
don't
see,
we don't want to forget Tracy Lindeman.
Of course, I can.
The court. She keeps us very well organized.
Thank you, Justice Perigary. And sitting in front is Tracy Lindeman, who's the clerk of the Supreme Court, who kind of makes this all happen. You know, like that, we couldn't function without her and scheduling and all that. So we want to acknowledge Tracy and thank her for all her efforts in setting up the this appearance at Palo Verde High School today. Before, you know, last spring, Tom Standish and his daughter Julia visited with me up in Carson City, and I was telling them about how we go to high schools all around the state for oral arguments, you know, once or twice a year. And Tom and Julia said, well, can you come to Palo Verde High School here in Las Vegas? And I said, sure, I'd love to, and I'll talk to my colleagues about that. I mean, my daughter is a graduate of Palo Verde High School. And
I've got one, too.
Yeah, and Justice Perigary has one and graduated from Palo Verde High School as well. And mine has gone to law school and just passed the bar exam, so just became an attorney. And I know Justice Perigary's daughter's in Spain studying right now. And I,
actually, this is the oldest one that made me a grandfather.
Oh, okay. We didn't
so
know you were
that
old.
It's been a few years.
Yeah, that's
true. I'm not. I don't mention it often.
He doesn't mention it often, but that's great. So we do have some family ties here with the court to Palo Verde High School as well. So what we're going to do today is we'll have a case. This is a criminal case, and how this case came to us is this. Is you can see there's seven justices here today, and we have a total of seven on the Supreme Court, but because of our large workload, what we do is a lot of times is divide into panels of three of us, and the three of us would hear cases. And then on occasion, the court will come back and say, well, look, maybe they'll, even though the three of you already heard it, maybe it's a good idea if we look at it again and have all seven of us take a look at it. That's what happened in this particular case you're going to hear next, is a panel of three justices had decided this case, and then in this particular instance, counsel for the appellant here, Sharon Dickinson, and we'll introduce the attorneys in 1 minute, filed a petition for en banc reconsideration. And in English, that means all seven of us to take a look at it. And we got that petition in, and we decided that, yes, this might be an appropriate case to, for all seven of us to take a look at it as well. So even though it's been decided by a panel, the full court can take a look at the case later on. We don't do it that often, but we did on this particular case because it has some interesting issues which you'll hear about from both sides in just a few minutes. So with that background, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce the attorneys, and then I'm going to ask the attorneys before we start the clock and all to tell us a little bit about the case from their perspective, and then we'll go ahead and start the formal oral arguments. When the oral arguments are done, we're going to throw it open to questions from all of you as students, questions you might have about the case, and you're going to ask, you'd be able to ask questions to the attorneys or to the court. We can't tell you how we're going to vote on it because we don't know yet. That's one reason we have oral arguments. We read a lot of written materials, and we have a lot of them here in these cases. And we do lots of reading on this job. And then once we've read it, then we hear from the attorneys, and then we're going to ask them questions during the oral arguments. And then when we're done, the seven of us will get together, and we'll decide the case. And every case that we decide is always done in writing. So it's a little different than court cases you see on TV and all, where the judge decides everything on the spot. I mean, we decide everything in writing, so we'll prepare written decisions. Usually takes 90 to 120 days from today to get those written decisions out, and that's how the attorneys find out about the results of the case. So that's kind of the background and how we operate. So this particular case, we have Ms. Dickinson, Sharon Dickinson, representing the appellant. Now, Sharon was an attorney with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I know several of us on the court. She was in front of us a lot when we used to be district court judges, so we know Sharon very well, and we've had many, many cases over the years. And also on behalf of the state of Nevada, we have Agnes Lexus, and Ms. Lexus is here as well. Also does excellent work in the trial court level for the Clark County District's Attorney's Office. So she's coming down from the RJC today as well, the Regional Justice Center, to represent the state of Nevada through the Clark County District Attorney's Office. So with that in mind, Ed, we'll go ahead and call this next case, which is case number 58904. It is Montano Rayon. I'm trying to do it in Spanish properly. Ms. Dickinson's my guy. Okay. And very well. I'll take your pronunciation is better than mine. And so he's versus the state of Nevada. So we'll go ahead, Ms. Dickinson. Before we start the clock again, if you can turn around and address the students, but tell us what this case is about from your perspective here, and then we'll hear from Ms. Alexis as well. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Lexus, you'd like to give the state's perspective on this? If you want to use the microphone, too, feel free to do that.
Good morning, Calabrese. In this particular case, the defendant was charged with three different felonies. Mr. Jung Lee was a store owner, smoke shop, on the northeast side of town. And when he reported to work one morning as he was filling the soda coolers, the defendant, or the appellant in this particular case, comes in, accosts him, and brings out a knife and puts it towards Mr. Lee and demands money. He wants his wallet. Mr. Lee points to where his cash register is, says, "I'll have my wallet way over there." It's at that point, which is shown at trial, that the defendant took the knife and tried to stab Mr. Lee. What the defendant didn't know was that Mr. Lee was trained in martial arts. He served in the South Korean Army, and while he had practiced martial arts in a long time, he still knew how to defend himself. So as the defendant went to stab him, Mr. Lee used his left hand to kind of push the knife away, and then used his other hand to basically karate chop the defendant in the neck, causing the defendant to fall back and run from the store. So the next morning, after Mr. Lee was treated for his injury, he did get a stab wound to his left shoulder. After he was treated, he goes back to the store, goes back to work, and as he's filling the soda coolers, he sees that the defendant had left his work bag right there by the soda cooler. So the owner, Mr. Lee, picks up the bag, looks at it, it has some of his blood on it, and he says, "Oh, this is the guy that just tried to rob me." He calls the police. They do additional
Thank you very much, Ms. Alexis. Again, students, just for a little background information, you're going to hear in the argument, we have a number of issues that will be discussed, but I thought what I might do is talk about how juries are picked in criminal cases, because there's an issue that's going to come up in this case, and I know the attorney's times are limited on presenting their arguments, so just to give you some context on it. But generally, in a criminal trial, you have 12 jurors in a case, and to reach a verdict, it has to be a vote to 12 to nothing, either for guilty or not guilty. It has to be unanimous. In a civil case, you have 8 jurors in Nevada, and it does not have to be unanimous. You only have to have 6 out of those 8 jurors to reach a verdict, or 75% of the total amount of the jury. Now, in both criminal and civil cases, we have what we call alternate jurors, which are jurors that are not, in a criminal case, they're not part of the 12 that actually decide the case, but if any of the 12 maybe get sick or have to be excused before the trial's over, you need to have other people to step in that have already heard the case, and they can come in and serve as seated from as being regular jurors, even though they're designated as alternate jurors at some point in time. So an issue in this case will be how you select alternate jurors. You know, it's done in several different methods, and we're going to hear from the parties about how the judges do it and whether they agree if whether it's proper under the current state law how it's done. So just to give you that idea, when we get to that issue, that's why it's how it's going to come up. So with that background, Ms. Dickinson, if you go ahead and proceed on behalf of the appellant.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Rogelio Martinez-Laureano. This is a case about words. Words matter. Words are used to express anger, or words can be used to just simply say thank you. Words matter. And when you have an obligation to say something and you don't, that matters also. That is what this issue is about. In this case, the court did not say the words it had an obligation to say under NRS 175.061 subsection 4. Under that section, when a judge is going to replace a juror who is deliberating in the jury room with an alternate who was not there, the judge has to do certain things, certain procedures, and use certain words. What the judge has to do is bring the jury back into the courtroom, all 11 that are left, reseat the alternate juror, and then resubmit the case to the jury. Basically, tell the jury to begin deliberations anew. And that's very important.
As to that issue, what is our standard in this case? If I remember the record correctly, there was no objection by the defense as to not giving the restart instruction.
That is correct.
What is our standard?
Our standard here is the state has the burden of proving this error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because this is a constitutional error. Under the Sixth Amendment, the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, and under the Nevada Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, a defendant in a criminal case has a right to a trial by a fair and impartial jury. In fact, the Sixth Amendment specifically says he has a right to an impartial jury in the district where the crime has occurred. The 14th Amendment provides that no state may deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within his jurisdiction equal protection of laws. The Nevada Constitution says the right of a trial by jury shall be secured to all and remain inviolate forever. Now, the Ninth Circuit summed up these rights quite succinctly in Dean versus Hawker. They said, the right to be found guilty only by the unanimous verdict of the 12 persons on the jury. This right embraces the right to have the independent judgment of each juror, and the courts may not substitute any other thought process. In accord with this reasoning, the Nevada legislature enacted NRS 175.021, which requires a jury of 12 people in a criminal case, and NRS 175.481, which says the verdict shall be unanimous. This is the same as the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 31.
Ms. Dickinson, what you're saying is important. In our factual context of this case, we had a juror dismissed, we had a new juror inserted, the jury began deliberation, which is in debate again, and they seem to go from, if the record is accurate, about 4 hours and 30 minutes before they reached a verdict. So as to what you've been saying, how is that affected by that factual context?
Well, the way it was affected is that the jury went out in about an hour, within an hour, sent a note to the judge that one juror said they thought they knew the victim from 2 years ago, from being in the store. The juror removed that juror from the courtroom. So now we have 11 people in the jury room still deliberating. We have one in an alternate courtroom. She calls the attorneys who come into court and question this juror. Defense objected to removing the juror. Court denied the objection and said, we're going to add the alternate. So this is what she did. She didn't bring the entire jury back in the courtroom. They were still back there deliberating, the 11 of them. She didn't seat the alternate. She didn't resubmit them to the jury. What she said is, on the record, I'll just have my assistant take the alternate back and have the marshal say, you know, tell them to go ahead and deliberate. And they did, with a new person introduced, for about 40 minutes that day.
And Ms. Dickinson, at that point, did you or whomever was in the courtroom at that time say, Judge, you know, you have to re-instruct, the statute says that you have to bring the jury back. Did anyone make that statement?
No one did. They were arguing vigorously about removing the juror, and no one made that statement or objection, but I suggest it's plain error because it's a constitutional violation. Now, the court asked me to look at the Carroll case with regard to this, and I did. And I saw the Carroll case doesn't cite the U.S. Constitution or the Nevada Constitution, but it does cite several cases that do. And specifically, the Carroll case, which we relied on, refers to People versus Collins in California. And in that case, what happened is the California court relied on the California Constitution. The Carroll case also cited to the Ninth Circuit case of Lamb. In that case, they reversed based on the federal rules that are just like the Nevada rules. And in that case, there actually was an admonition, but they said it wasn't good enough in that case because the jury had come in with a verdict and then they were sent back. But getting to the Collins case, when I read that and saw that we had relied on that, I compared the California Constitution with the Nevada Constitution. They're very similar. Both of them have almost the exact same words when it says the right to a trial by jury shall be secured to all and remain forever inviolate. What California has in their statute, which we don't specifically have, is they also say that you have a right to a unanimous verdict. But if you look at Article 1, Section 3 of the Nevada Constitution, you'll see that it talks about, in civil cases, there may not be a right to a unanimous verdict. They don't use those words. But by inference, only discussing the civil cases and not the criminal.
Did the judge tell the 11 to stop deliberating? Was there?
There's no evidence in the record that she did.
Is there any evidence in the record that the jury deliberated for any significant period of time?
Well,
there's an assertion, but there's no citation and there's no support for it that I could see.
Oh, we were relying by the times the court went in and off the record, because those were the only time periods we have. So it was about 2 hours, I believe, before they put the alternate in. So we know that there were some sort of deliberations going on. In fact, there was a note from one of the jurors, from the juror form, and asking a question about the victim's voluntary statement.
Was there a motion for new trial?
No, there was not.
There's an indication that perhaps 80% of the time that the jurors deliberated, this time occurred after the alternate was seated. How was there not a unanimous jury here, a jury verdict here? You keep referring to the fact that this defendant is entitled to a unanimous verdict.
Well,
was there not one here?
Well, the reason I'm relying on the unanimous verdict is that's what the Collins and California case did, because you need to have the independent judgment of each juror come in, deliberate, discuss the issues, discuss their viewpoints on the evidence, and come up with a consensus.
And if you have, for the sake of argument, if you have all 12 jurors 80% of the time being able to deliberate and discuss the issues, how does that affect your argument?
The problem is that when you have 11 people deliberating without the 12, which is required by law, they can come up to agreements that the other one is not privy to. And
is there any evidence of that here?
Well, we don't know what the jury does in the jury room.
Well, it sounds like we have ineffective assistance of counsel, which is not viable on appeal, because how could this attorney not let Judge Scann know what her duty was under the statute? And more importantly, how could this attorney not move for a new trial and have an evidentiary hearing and ask the jury, what did you do when 11 of you were together? So isn't this ineffective assistance of counsel, and that should be on habeas corpus rather than an appeal?
I would disagree. I believe it's the court's burden to follow the rules in instructing the jury. And I believe that it's plain error that can be addressed on direct appeal, because in this case, the court not only didn't follow the mandates of the statute, the court violated the Constitution, the Nevada Constitution.
But wouldn't it be better if the attorney had stood up and said, Your Honor, you need to stop the 11 from deliberating, number one, and number two, you need to re-instruct the jury to start from the beginning. They can't go with what they have already decided. The 12 had decided when one of them's removed.
Well, the state could have done that also. I think everybody was busy arguing about the other jurors, so they perhaps didn't even notice that she hadn't done that.
This was an inexperienced judge who mainly did civil work as an attorney. Is that correct?
I believe this was her first criminal
That's
trial.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Why? Just a question for you. Why couldn't this be used as a strategic defense tactic not to make an objection? Then come back later saying, it's plain error, it's a constitutional error, and this defendant goes. And that's the reason that we have the plain error rules and the harmless error analysis, but tell me why it couldn't just as easily be a strategic a tactic by a defense counsel to not make an objection, not make an issue of it until the trial's over. Rather than letting the judge address it and correct it, in the first place.
This was a 9-day trial. There were lots of objections, lots of sidebars. In fact, there were continued objections. So I don't believe that was an issue in this case. In fact, at one time, the court told defense counsel just to sit down. There were a lot of objections and a lot of things going on. It was a long trial. So I'm not sure why this was not objected to, but it is plain error of a constitutional magnitude. If I could reserve the rest of my time.
You may do so. Thank you very much. Okay, and Ms. Alexis, you have proceed. Also, perhaps you could address the lottery method of selecting alternate jurors as well, because I anticipate Ms. Dickinson will bring that up in a rebuttal.
Okay. Your Honors, if it's okay, I'd like to begin with addressing whether or not this particular error, if it was in fact error, is of a constitutional dimension. The short answer is no, it is not. The reason is, if different courts can have, or from different jurisdictions, can have different rules based on different statutes or different court rules about what it is, whether you should instruct, and what the actual instruction should say, that kind of lends credence to the argument that it is not of a constitutional dimension.
Well, is it ineffective assistance of counsel then? It has to be one or the other, because it wasn't right. The judge did not do what the judge was mandated to do by our legislature. So is it ineffective assistance of counsel, or is it a constitutional error?
Your Honor, I don't know about the ineffective assistance of counsel. From my experience, this was a very contentious trial. I believe both defense attorneys tried very hard, very passionately, to advocate for this particular defendant or the appellant in this particular case. I don't believe it was ineffective assistance of counsel at all. I also don't believe that it is of a constitutional dimension. Because
how can
the
you say that in light of the Carroll case?
Your Honor, if we are to take, just to kind of do a brief discussion of Carroll, Carroll essentially adopted language from a federal rule of criminal procedure, number 24C3. That particular federal rule of criminal procedure states, if an alternate replaces a juror after deliberations have begun, the court must instruct a jury to begin its deliberations anew. Now, I would just point the court to our statutory language. It doesn't say that you have to begin deliberations anew. It just means you have to resubmit the case to the jury. So there's a little bit of a difference. I believe Carroll adopted this federal mandate, and subsequent to that, Nevada ended up with a mandate that says we need to begin anew. I don't believe that's what our statute required.
But that's what the case law says.
That's correct. That's what Carroll says. So if you look at Carroll in depth, though, and I believe opposing counsel did this as well, several cases citing to Carroll or cited in the Carroll decision, an Arizona case, which is State versus Guyon, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 11th circuits, have all held that this is not a constitutional issue.
But other jurisdictions have clearly held an opposite to that.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that they've done certain analysis in other jurisdictions, and depending on which jurisdiction, for instance, let me give you an example. In Evans, which is a Fourth Circuit case from 1980, the court held there was no prejudice in this particular case because the juror had been replaced. The jury was only told to continue with deliberations, not specifically to begin deliberations again. There was no objection as to the lack of that specific instruction, and the court said nothing precluded the jury from starting deliberations over again, and the court held no prejudice was found. And I think in that particular case, after looking at it, I believe a plain error standard of review was employed in that particular case. Now, the Evans case, which Guy incited to, also talks about another case, which is from the 11th Circuit, Peek versus Kemp. That court held that any alleged prejudice suffered by the appellant in that case is speculative because just like this case, the jury was not prevented from starting over. The alternate juror had attended the entire trial. The alternate juror had heard the charge of the original jury. The original juror was questioned and selected by the same methods that the original jurors were, and the alternate juror had reviewed the case with the jury after that particular alternate joined them. And I know the court made reference to the amount of time that the alternate had with the original jurors. It was four times the amount of time that the original jurors had to deliberate this particular case.
Do we know what the court's assistant and the marshal actually said to the 11 when they went back there? What did they say?
We do not know, Your Honor.
Don't you think it would have been appropriate for the judge to allow that to be on the record so that we could decide? I mean, the record's empty now. We don't know what they said.
That's true, Your Honor.
And they're not lawyers.
That's true, Your Honor. It is empty. What we do have on the record is what Judge Scan said, which was that she would have the alternate seated and ask the marshal and the assistant to go ahead and tell them to deliberate. That's what our record shows. And I guess absent any evidence to the contrary, that's
well,
what
we have. You
can't
have evidence if the judge won't allow you to have evidence. And this judge did not allow defense attorney to speak to the jurors as to what happened.
That's correct, but it was after we had a hearing concerning, what this particular juror, which was substituted, had undergone during the first hour or so of deliberations.
How long were the 11 together?
Your Honor, I did the math while co-counsel or opposing counsel was speaking. I show 25 minutes based on the timestamps. And there is absolutely no evidence on the record, and I know that's partly you know, a problem, that they began, that they continued deliberations.
Well, no evidence in the record is allowing, it's the same thing as allowing somebody kills their mother and father to throw themselves on the mercy of the court because they're an orphan. Am I correct? And usually I get a laugh with that, but I guess I didn't.
I'm too nervous to laugh. But I don't know what happened with the 11. What I know is that the juror who was substituted out was sequestered, and there was a brief hearing, and for 25 minutes of being in that room by themselves, and then you have another 4 hours and 44 minutes where the alternate sat and deliberated with the 11 original jurors. And what you have during that time also is a break. They deliberated that same day during the substitution for 40 minutes. There was an evening break. They came back at 9 o'clock the next day and deliberated for 4 hours and 4 minutes. During that time, they were able to ask the court for a replay of a certain testimony by the detective, which the court allowed. And they were able to deliberate and come to a conclusion together before they announced it. Also, what I'd like to point out is that these jurors, Your Honors, were polled after they rendered this verdict. After the verdict was read and they unanimously said that was their verdict, they were polled.
That's where they just say, is that your verdict? And they say, yes, 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 yes.
That's correct.
So I don't want the students to think that they were actually talked to about what they did during the 25 minutes that they were alone.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. But they were polled. And the point is that this alternate juror was asked, Mr. Owens was asked, is this your verdict as it was read? And he said, yes, it is. I think absent any kind of evidence that there was actual prejudice, and I know the court knows this, but it is the appellant's duty to talk and show actual prejudice, not speculation, but actual prejudice. And this case is very different from the Carroll decision. There's a very new case coming out of the Fourth Circuit from 2013, United States versus Runyon. And they did a very, very fact-specific analysis. And that court ultimately looked at the time frame of the deliberations with the substitutes and with the alternates. The site on that is 707 F3rd 475-519 out of the Fourth Circuit. And they talked about how the alternate juror deliberated for a consistently longer period than with the substituted juror. And then they looked at the same factors that I read off, such as, you know, the alternate juror attended the same trial, listened to the same evidence, and they found that the court, that the district court instructing the jury, failing to instruct the jury to begin deliberations anew, would not have made any difference to the course of the deliberations and thus the ultimate outcome. Other jurisdictions, Fifth Circuit. This particular case, United States versus Phillips, 664 F2nd 971, ultimately held that such an instruction was not mandated as a matter of constitutional right. And I believe that should be law in Nevada as well. And it makes sense.
The position taken in the Fourth Circuit, too, that it's not a constitutional requirement.
Yes, Your Honor.
But let's assume for the moment that this court disagrees and treats this type of error as a constitutional error. What would be your analysis in upholding the verdict?
Your Honor.
What would be your analysis in upholding the verdict in this case if the court were to conclude that this is a constitutional error and examines it for plain error?
Your Honor, the evidence was great in this particular case. And also, I mean, there's really not been a showing of any kind of prejudice. What we have is evidence to the contrary, and to assume any kind of prejudice would be speculating. If we do a plain error analysis, the defendant's substantial right was not infringed upon in this
particular case.
So your point
is that even if it's a constitutional error, it's not structural, requiring reversal. It's subject to harmless error analysis.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It would be more of a trial-level constitutional error as opposed to structural. Similar to failing to give a limiting instruction or failing to instruct the jury not to read the newspaper while they are on a jury, as I read cases concerning this issue, that came up a lot, or the failure to hold a hearing regarding the admissibility of jury questions. I think it's akin to that kind of error, if we call it that. I don't believe it's structural at all. I believe the analysis would be harmless error. But in this particular case, if I may say, because of the lack of objection, I believe the plain error analysis applies. If you consider it not a constitutional dimension type of issue. I read in the appellant's brief, they indicated they did object to the substitution of the juror, but again, they did not object to the court giving this lack of a specific instruction. And that's kind of where this case is particular to me, because what is stopping the defense bar from just causing a mistrial or from causing error?
What stops the district attorney's office from abolishing the statute so you don't have to do this? Say we don't, it's not error, so we don't need to do it anymore. Maybe you guys ought to go to the legislature and say, we don't need this. We don't need to have the jury instructed about being receiving AR, that they need to start over.
I'll let Mr. Wolfson know. So, Your Honor, the respondent is confident that there was no actual showing of prejudice, let alone actual prejudice. The jurors were individually polled, as I indicated. And during their over 4 hours of deliberation, I'm confident that the alternate and the original jurors who viewed this trial received evidence together, who deliberated together, unanimously agreed to find the defendant or the appellant guilty of all of the charges. And this was after a 9-day trial where they sat and listened to all of the evidence. I don't think there's been any kind of showing of prejudice, and I do not think that this warrants reversal.
Okay. Ms. Alexis, on the alternate selection at the beginning of the case, if I could summarize, I think, how the different ways of doing it. There's one system where you select 14 jurors at one time, allow 5 peremptory challenges, and then at the end of the case, before the jury goes into deliberation, the clerk randomly selects 2 people as alternates, and you tell them at the beginning of the case there will be 2 alternates, and there's 14 left. To get them, I think the theory is to pay more attention. Nobody can speculate if they're an alternate. Versus where you have pick 14, designate maybe seats 13 and 14 as the alternate, and they can exercise 1 peremptory challenge, 1 of their 5 against that alternate. In this case, I know Ms. Dickinson's challenging whether the lottery method could be used, but was there any objection to that process employed by the judge to select the jury?
There was not, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have any other thoughts about that process, about judges that do that?
No, not really, Your Honor. Okay. I don't.
Okay. Anything else you want to add? You got about a minute left.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Unless
I think that's
for
the students.
Like
that's not our bell here, but I understand the students, if you wouldn't mind staying so we can finish up the arguments, and then we'll answer some questions and all as well. So thank you very much, Ms. Alexis, and then we'll hear from Ms. Dickinson in her rebuttal argument.
Ms. Dickinson, as you approach, I have a couple of questions. It appears that there was a significant amount of time for deliberation by the jury after the alternate was seated, and it also appears that the polling indicated a unanimous verdict. Notwithstanding the requirement by Constitution for a unanimous verdict, fair and impartial, et cetera, what is the prejudice that you allege occurred in this case?
That's a golden term. The prejudice that occurred is that I think we need to step away from what we're looking at, the time and the deliberations, and look at what words were or were not used. If you look at the time, the amount of the time they deliberated after the alternate joined them does not answer the critical question of whether the jury began to deliberate anew. We don't know. They were not instructed to do that. The deliberations, the objection, object of deliberations is to secure a unanimous verdict by a comparison of views and arguments among the jurors.
But presumably we have that evidence right before us during the polling.
But a unanimous verdict does not necessarily mean unanimity was obtained through discussions with this added juror, expressing their views on the evidence and the other 11 taking that into consideration. So that is the prejudice. We have to look at the words. The words and the manner in which the court instructs the jury protects the defendant's right to a fair and impartial jury, and a right to a verdict that is actually unanimous with everybody contributing. And so that's the prejudice. I know that.
Did the defense counsel ask for the opportunity to present affidavits from jurors or to call them in a hearing that would disclose the specific nature of the discussions in the jury room?
I don't recall that occurring, no.
The record would suggest, and I'm sorry I don't have the actual cite, but the record does seem to indicate that counsel at the time of trial was not allowed to question the jury. But you weren't the trial lawyer, is that correct?
I was not the trial attorney. So that may have happened after the verdict. I wanted to touch briefly on the Carroll case. The prosecutor cited an Arizona case, Evans, and many federal cases. None of those came out of Carroll. In fact, some of those, the first time I heard them was at this, when she said them at the podium. The federal cases are different than the Carroll case, and different than the Collins case out of California. And there they said, under the federal constitution, there was no right to the unanimous verdict. But in 2010, in McDonald versus City of Chicago, the United States Supreme Court, in a footnote, discussed the decisions that would suggest that maybe there is not a right to a unanimous verdict. And in doing so, it is suggested that that opinion may not be totally correct. So when she is discussing the federal cases, they're based on a case that was a 4-1-4 decision, which our current Supreme Court may not affirm.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Dickinson. No other questions from the court, I assume. Thank you very much for your excellent arguments and briefs. And what we'd like to do now is throw it open to the students for some questions, which you can ask either attorney, and you can address questions to the court. I mean, we can't answer, like I said before, what we're going to do yet, because we haven't decided. We have to go meet and see how we're going to vote to resolve this particular case. So if there's any questions here, we'll go ahead and start. Yes. Could you stand up, and maybe you can focus on your students there and so they can hear you then. Okay, and Ms. Dickinson, if you want to get up next to the microphone, you can go ahead and use that.
The court asked us before we...
I think that's a school bell. So you can,
okay. Before we came here to argue, the court had asked us to review the Carroll case and argue about that case. So that was the reason I went into the Carroll case and discussed what was the basis for our Supreme Court's decision in Carroll. And in our Supreme Court's decision, they relied on California, and they relied on the Ninth Circuit. So that's why I discussed the Nevada Constitution and compared it to California's Constitution.
Thank you very much. And one thing I'd like to point out, I think, as a supplement to that, is you heard both attorneys argue a number of cases, and they gave legal citations to those cases. Generally, at the Nevada Supreme Court, we have to decide our cases based on Nevada statutes or laws that are written or previous cases decided by the Nevada Supreme Court. So we rely on those to make our future decisions. A lot of times we get issues that are not addressed by statute or by our previous cases, then so we will look then to other states or other federal courts, like the you heard Fourth Circuit, Fifth Circuit. Those are federal courts of appeals around the country. So we look at how they decided it. That's not binding on us, but we can use that as what we call persuasive authority to make our decisions. So that's the reason the attorneys do that and make those arguments. Okay, any other questions? Yes, I see one down here. Ms. Alexis, you want to take a shot at that one here? And then, good, very good question, by the way.
I'm in kind of a difficult position because as a prosecutor, after we get a guilty verdict, my office is charged with protecting basically saying that the judge did everything right, the defense attorney did everything right, and we did everything right, so that we can see the verdict.
Thank you very much. Any more questions? Yes, I see one in the middle here. Yes, sir, if you could speak as loud as you could so we can all hear it. If you want to pull the microphone towards you too, Ms. Dickinson, it might help.
It's difficult to say definitively yes, but I know that when you have a group of people, they all discuss things and they're trying to interchanging ideas. And if you have one person that's not part of that group, and then you bring them in after they've already made decisions, you're not going to get the same result as if you had all 12 people talking and discussing the evidence together. So yes, it's a very strong possibility there could have been a different decision. Or there could have been a hung jury. Well, or the juror could have decided that they were not going to vote for guilty, and then they would not have a unanimous verdict.
Thank you. Yes, I see a question back here.
Your question a little bit differently as to whether or not there's a conviction. I look as to whether or not the process was fair and whether a defendant's constitutional rights were protected, which I believe the court is there to do. So when the procedures are against the statute and against the Constitution, then I feel it's important that the defendant gets a new trial with the rules being followed correctly, because we want to make sure that no innocent person is convicted unjustly.
Would this new trial give a different result? Because there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that's
Well, I don't see it as an overwhelming amount of evidence, but if the one case that we cited, there was an overwhelming amount of evidence. That's the Carroll case. And in that case, even though there was overwhelming evidence, the Mass Supreme Court reversed the conviction for the new trial.
Okay, thank you for giving. Yes, we have another question. This
young lady right there.
Yes, would you stand up? And thank you, ma'am. Go ahead.
Her time of 25 minutes is what we know. Everybody was in court, and that was with the one juror that was removed. It was actually more than an hour before they ended up getting into court. So we know that 11 people were deliberating in the jury room for almost 2 hours before they added a new person. And I think that's a significant amount of time. But even if it was 25 minutes, if you have people making decisions, well, if all 11 of them made a decision, another one came in, they really wouldn't have a voice. It wouldn't be because they'd have 11 against one person. But whatever decision it is, and there's three different crimes with different elements. They may have decided one conviction on one and not the other. We don't know what they were doing.
Okay,
I don't know what they decided during that period of time, and I don't think anybody knows. We don't have a record. The time is irrelevant in only to the fact that if you have 11 people making a decision for 2 hours and then you bring another person in there, that 12th juror just is not able to express their views and their opinion, because the jury decides the credibility of all the witnesses. People in the courtroom, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the court, all of who participated in this, and no one said, wait a minute, bring the jury back in. I am the head of the court. The court controls the courtroom.
The lawyers should have stepped up and the officers have been
provided. I'm not saying they couldn't, but they should have. I'm saying that's primarily because the court should have done this. The court has specific directives under the statute. The court didn't do this.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see. I don't know if we have time for any more questions, Tracy. I don't think I see any. Is there one more? We'll get one. And yeah, I got to commend you. I think we've got a lot of good future lawyers out here. I have very good questions for all of us to think about this. So go ahead, sir, with your question.
Yeah,
table.
Thank you, Ms. Alexis. I think it's very interesting that you point out the role of the state in searching for the truth, so we appreciate you bringing that comment up. If we could do this, can you join me in giving a round of applause to all of the both the attorneys here today? I tell you, the Supreme Court, all of us up here were kind of talking about how impressed we were with the students and the questions, and also it's really been a pleasure to come out here and appear in front of you and have these two fine lawyers argue their cases and proceed forward. So with that.